You are tuned to WBAI in New York and WBAI.org on the World Wide Web. The preceding program, the Personal Computer Show, was brought to you live with certain portions on recording. The Joy of Resistance with Fran Look is coming up next. Please, please stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale, host and producer of Ecologic here on WBAI, and I want to tell you about a wonderful environmental and music festival, the Clearwater Great Hudson River Revival. Besides five stages of incredible music, a stage just for kids, dozens of craftspeople, and a beautiful view of the Hudson River, there are dozens of activist tables covering nearly every environmental issue from solar energy to fracking to life on the Hudson River. Get connected. Get educated. Visit the WBAI booth. Most of all, have fun. It's Father's Day weekend, June 16th and 17th at Croton Point Park in Westchester. Metro North will get you there. For more info, go to www.clearwaterfestival.org.
Sunshine, when you're with me, I can fly.
30 years ago on June 12th, over a million people gathered in Central Park to protest against nuclear energy and weaponry. To commemorate the beautiful memories and break through the anti-nuclear movement, we are going to walk again.
Come to Tompkins Square Park in the East Village at 7:30 p.m. Bring your radio or boombox to the march and tune to Ecologic at 8 p.m. Instead of speakers and music on a stage, authors Chris Williams and Alice Slater will discuss nuclear power and weapons on WBAI. Minori Nakamura will talk about Indian Point and Fukushima, and the Raging Grannies will be performing live music.
That's Tuesday, June 12th, 7:30 p.m. at Tompkins Square Park, and 8 p.m. right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Bring your radio.
Be mobile.
No more nukes.
Hi, this is Alec Baldwin, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Anything can happen.
Support WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
Anything can happen.
And the time is 9 p.m. here at WBAI New York and WBAI.org, and we hear next the Joy of Resistance.
Joy of Resistance. We're sisters of the joy of resistance. No corporation, government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy of resistance. We have found the joy in resistance. For those who gain by keeping women down, we say your numbers up, don't underestimate our persistence. Joy of resistance. We have found the joy in resistance. We got a way to go before we're free. We're keeping organized together. We have come a long distance. Joy, joy of resistance. We're sisters of the joy of resistance. No corporation, government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy.
And good evening. This is Fran Luck, and this is The Joy of Resistance. And we are so happy to be back after a month and a half hiatus, including the fun drive. And we've got a lot to present to you tonight. So very much has been going on in the world of women's activism. Well, both good and bad. It's almost like time has speeded up. There's been so much stuff. The right wing of this country has been going for broke in trying to pass bills to take away our rights. And at the same time, there's been more feminist activism than I've seen in a really long time. On April 24th, in 54 cities, for instance, there were rallies under the banner Unite to Fight the War Against Women. On May 5th in New York City, there was a program at the Brecht Forum called What's Next for Feminism in New York City, and that was very well attended. And then on May 17th, there was the first ever New York City Feminist General Assembly of Occupy Wall Street. And that was a long time in coming. And lastly, last week, May 29th, at the Center, the Ethical Culture Society, there was a panel called The Resurgence of Misogyny with Kate Pollitt, Katha Pollitt, and many others. So tonight, we're going to focus on the last two events. We have live in the studio some of the organizers of the Feminist General Assembly, and we will have some sounds from it. And let me just say hello to Lorena and to Dior. And just say hello to everybody.
Hi, everyone.
And we'll be back with you in a little bit after the news. And we're also going to have Judith Levine on the phone. She's another organizer. So that should be really exciting because this was a wonderful event.
Thank you.
First, some of, I'm afraid, the mostly bad news. Yesterday, June 5th, Republicans blocked the Paycheck Fairness Act, which would have barred employers from retaliating against workers who shared information on wages, and women members and other discriminated against groups would not be able to seek back pay, but could also seek punitive damages for pay discrimination. They would be blocked from seeking back pay. The GOP claimed the bill was a war on free enterprise, and Republican Senator Rand Paul compared it to a, quote, paycheck Politburo. Its proponents say it would have drastically leveled the playing field for women in the workforce, who still make an average of 77 cents for every dollar that men make. We also have a very regressive version of the Violence Against Women Act that has passed the House. Since 1994, the Violence Against Women Act, which authorizes funding for protection against violent abuse, has been reauthorized. But on May 16th, the Republican-dominated House of Representatives passed a version that, according to the Center for American Progress, quote, rolls back progress and threatens the health and safety of many Americans living in violent or abusive relationships. According to the National Organization for Women, H.R. 4970 entirely excludes lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer victims. It enhances abusers' power over immigrant women by allowing immigration agents to contact abusers and hear their complaints about the immigration status of their victims. It fails to address the crisis of violence against American Indian women by not recognizing tribal court authority, and that holds perpetrators accountable. And it rolls back resources for women of color and their communities that were gained in 2005. Representative Carol Lynn Maloney said the House Republican version of the Violence Against Women Act is, quote, just another assault in what was has sadly and surely become known as the Republican War Against Women, close quote. President Obama has threatened to veto the bill if the House provisions stand. And you can find out how to put pressure on representatives by going to the National Organization for Women website at www.now.org. By the way, we are running this news and links to many other sources for it on our Joy of Resistance blog, which is at joyofresistance.wordpress.com. So be sure to go there. And as long as you are at your computer, you might want to look at the WBAI website, where we have a wonderful picture of the Feminist General Assembly. And that's at www.wbai.org. All right, on with the news. On May 12th in Indiana, a court of appeals let stand a decision that resulted in murder charges against a pregnant woman who, while depressed, tried to commit suicide and whose baby after birth did not survive. Bebe Shway, jailed for 14 months, now out on bail, was charged under a feticide statute supposedly designed to protect pregnant women from external violence. The case is considered to have grave implications for the constitutional rights and personhood of all pregnant women. According to Lynn Paltrow of National Advocates for Pregnant Women, any health care provider can now say to a pregnant patient who disagrees with his treatment that he will report her to state authorities under feticide laws. And women who have miscarriages can conceivably face murder charges. And we have a link to a press conference you really should listen to on our blog. And you can hear Lynn Paltrow saying this and much more about the implications of this bill. And again, that's joyofresistance.wordpress.com. There's also a change.org position on this case. a couple of local stories. According to a story by David Graeber, an OWS activist and an anthropologist writing in the blog Kasama, there have been a mounting number of reports of women having had their breasts grabbed and or having been otherwise sexually assaulted by members of the NYPD during the arrests that have taken place at protests by Occupy Wall Street. Graeber says in his article at Kasama.org, quote, arbitrary violence is nothing new. The apparently systematic use of sexual assault against women protesters is new, and goes on to speculate about the connections between these tactics and tactics used by used against women by police forces around the world, specifically in recent protests in Egypt. To read the complete article, go to kasamaproject.org/2012, or you can see the entire article at again at joyofresistance.wordpress.org. Again, locally, Choices Women's Medical Center, established in 1971 and one of the first in New York State to perform abortions, has moved from its former Long Island City location to a new home in Jamaica, Queens. The move was a result of extreme landlord neglect at the previous location, and according to founder and CEO Merle Hoffman, the neglect is part of the picture of the many forms of harassment faced by clinics that perform abortions, even in New York City. And she has filed a FACE complaint, and that is a law which protects clinics against harassment. This reporter visited the reopened clinic, found it to be immaculate, state-of-the-art, and warm and welcoming, with walls hung with art relating to women's reproductive history and the history of the civil rights and feminist movements. Even before Choices reopened, anti-abortion protesters started protesting it. Last Saturday, about 20 were outside with big color signs supposedly of aborted fetuses. Your help is needed from 7 to 11 every Saturday to provide supportive climate and escort women into the clinic. And if you'd like to be part of that, send an email to news@choicesmedical.com. That's news@choicesmedical.com, and you can be part of the Choices support group. And we have one more story. Tens of thousands of women rallied in Turkey's largest city, Istanbul, to protest a new attempt to ban abortion in that nation. The Turkish Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has told his cabinet to prepare a law that would ban abortions after 4 weeks, effectively a ban. Turkey currently allows abortions until the 10th week. Erdogan, the head of an Islamic and business-oriented party, has recently said Turkey should emulate anti-abortion legislation in Western countries. To Tugba İze Bajik of the Istanbul Feminist Collective said, quote, if abortion is banned in Turkey, women will still have them, but under unhealthy and dangerous conditions. Marchers in the June 3rd rally in Istanbul carried banners that said, we are women, not reproductive machines. And some of that came from The Guardian, and you can see the other links in, again, in the Joy of Resistance blog, where we're posting all of our new stories so we don't have to go on too long on the show, which is short enough. And you can get to that at joyofresistance.wordpress.com. And now we'll take a little music break and come back and talk about the Feminist General Assembly, the first ever.
To the shame and the desperation. It's our bodies, our choice, our lives. Taking your laws off of our bodies. They strip the rights of the young and poor. Freedom of choice for each and every woman. That's the choice we are. We organize for rights we have struggled for.
You have been listening to a little bit of the sound from the first ever New York City Feminist General Assembly of OWS. There's a lot more where that came from, but first let me bring in our two studio guests, and we'll have another guest on the phone shortly. I want to introduce two of the organizers of this event, D.R. Vargas.
Hi.
Hi. So glad you're here.
Thank you so much.
And Lorena D'Ambrosio.
Yes. Thank you so much for having us.
Oh, thank you so much for organizing this extraordinary event. Let me tell you that when I got to Washington Square Park on May 17th and saw all the people there and just the beautiful setting and the arch and everything, and I thought, oh, this is just so wonderful. And then it started. And organizers came out and started saying, you know, welcome, mic check, and everyone was shouting, and people were laughing. And what you were hearing before as we came into this segment were some of the report backs that came a little bit later, okay, because everyone split into groups and had major discussions and came back and reported back to everybody. But let's go back to the beginning, and I believe we have our other guest who is on the phone, Judith Levine.
Hi.
Hi, good evening.
Nice to be here.
It's great to have you on Joy of Resistance. I'm sitting in the studio with Lorena and with Dior, and now you're on the phone, and we can start our discussion proper. The first thing I wanted to do was ask our in-studio guests to talk a little bit about how they got involved in this and how you all came up with this structure that was really so successful. And I'm going to ask you at that point, Judy, also to tell us your version of that. So who wants to take it off?
Okay. All right. So basically,
this is Lorena.
This is Lorena. Yes. How I got into it all is I saw the ad for the Feminist GA on the project list that OWS has, where they list all their events and stuff. And it so happened to be that that same day I met Melanie Golds, which was also one of the organizers. And she told me about it. She invited me to the planning group. I went to a meeting, and it's just how beautifully and inspiring everything was coming together, and just the fact that I was able to be part of that and just to grow the way that it did, it was very... It felt really good.
Sounds wonderful. Dior, did you have a similar experience?
Yes. My friend Natalie actually emailed me about
the organizing, and the minute I saw it, I knew that this was something that I had to get involved in. And so upon attending the first meeting, I realized how many people were there and you know, really excited about the prospect of having a General Assembly. And so as a feminist, I just knew I was in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, actually had that feeling, this event that had been waiting to happen. Yes. Why did you think it was important for this event to happen?
Oh, I think it was extremely important because just even, I first went to OWS back in October. It was actually for a musical gathering that some friends of mine were having. And you just feel that there's just not enough presence of feminism being such a big issue. It's just not enough. It's not enough at all. So I felt like this is definitely, it's been a long time coming with this, and I feel like it's great that it's finally happening now, you know. Okay. I definitely feel like it was much needed because just the voice of feminism was lacking at OWS a lot.
Okay. Dior, do you have similar feelings? Or
well, I wasn't really involved with OWS until I got involved with the first General Assembly, but I was aware of the fact that I didn't feel necessarily connected to OWS because I didn't see a lot of women or I didn't see a lot of people of color, and so I didn't necessarily identify. But once feminism was brought into the whole thing, I just knew that was a place that I feel like I could make a difference.
Yeah. We've done some programming in which we interviewed women who felt that women's voices were being spoken over, were not really being listened to, and more than anything felt that women's issues were somehow not front and center in the agenda of Occupy Wall Street. And that mirrors what women have experienced in just about every movement I can remember or have heard about that goes way back. Judith, let me bring you into this conversation. Why do you think this was an important event? And let me also say that you are of my generation of feminists, which kind of came out of what's called the second wave. And our two guests are from a much, much younger generation. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's part of the thrill of what I saw at the Feminist GA. And Judith, let me hear your take on why this was necessary and why you got involved.
Well, I also want to second how thrilling it is to work with young feminists. And I just feel so happy and impressed and trusting of this generation, especially the women who are in this planning group, who are great leaders and great consensus builders and great workers together. So I'm really happy to work with them. I first came into this because I, as a second-wave feminist, had been feeling, not only in Occupy but in the left in general, that feminism was getting lost, and a number of other women of my generation, a little affinity group called Take Back the Future, had first gotten together in 2003, right before the Iraq War, because we felt that the peace movement was again dropping feminism out. And when I say feminism, I don't just mean women's issues, and I think that's a great thing about this group, is we understand that feminism is a movement against domination of every kind. And so when Occupy came about as a movement for economic justice, it was distressing to feel that feminism again was being ignored. And furthermore, there was violence happening against women in the encampment.
That's right.
There was homophobia being expressed. There was domination by men in the assemblies and in some of the groups. And so women were experiencing exactly what my generation had and all mm-hmm. over the world women experience. So I started to just go to different Occupy meetings to get a sense of what was going on there, because Take Back the Future wanted to intervene by doing a little feminist course at OCU, which is the free university. So that's when I found the FemGA. And I also felt, as Dior did, that this was really a place that I could contribute to the Occupy movement that I feel so excited about?
Well, the excitement really showed. And one of the things that sparked my excitement when I got there was that the first part of the program for the evening was about a very old staple and organizing tool called consciousness raising.
Mm-hmm.
And I also saw Alex Shulman there, who's also of an older generation. And I wanted to ask you specifically how it came about that consciousness raising, which the second wave, the radical early part of the second wave, really built itself on, you know, mm-hmm. women sitting in circles and talking about our lives and trusting our feelings and our perceptions for once.
I'm not exactly sure how we first decided to do that as a little way to open up. Maybe it was Alex and me, or there were actually a number of other women of our generation in this group. Exactly what you're saying is it felt that not only in the feminist movement, in the history from then till now, but in our little moment of history at that GA in that night, it was so great to begin with the personal and then move out to the political, to start with getting to know each other, to talk about ourselves, to recognize the way you do in consciousness raising, even though this was only 15 minutes, that your experiences are shared by other people. They're not necessarily your fault. They have a systemic cause, that you can do something about that cause together, and that, you know, the personal is political and the political is personal. And furthermore, it gave us a way of just, in this very small moment, kind of bonding with each other. And that it really worked. And the last thing was, though, that we adopt, there's a way that occupies ways of being together, occupies conventions, are very similar to consciousness raising. And that is that each person gets her or his moment to talk, and the other people are just listening.
Yeah.
They're not contradicting. If they feel uncomfortable, they don't show their discomfort. They may show their support, but it's really a completely accepting kind of conversation. As Lisa, one of our people, said, in these little groups, there were two ears and one mouth.
Yeah. Well, it really is like a marriage made in heaven or something, that occupies style, the mic check style, and consciousness raising, which is such an original contribution to how we dialogue with each other and figure things out. I want to take it back to Lorena and Dior in the studio and ask you to describe the rest of the structure of the evening so our audience can get a sense of it.
Sure. Well, other than doing the consciousness raising in the first part, we broke out into separate groups again, this time larger groups, and we decided to talk about other things such as what the three main goals of feminism is today, and also what are we doing regarding these goals, and what are we going to do to bring change. And a lot of what was really important to us is not just having a conversation, but actually doing something about it, creating action items where we can implement these changes and do mm-hmm. something. So it's a lot of a long-term idea,
mm-hmm.
not just about what we're talking about at the GA, but what's going to happen afterwards and at the other following FMGAs.
Yeah. I was in one of those groups, and it was really exciting. You just thrust into a group. We're all sitting on the ground in Washington Square Park. We all found little areas. And, you know, we didn't know each other mostly, and trying to come to some kind of meeting of minds about, well, what are the goals of feminism? You know, we had just discussed in the consciousness-raising little group, what does feminism mean to you, kind of in a personal way. And now we were talking about what are the political goals. And there was some disagreement in our group, but we came to a couple of similarities, and I just want to know what your take was on that part of it, which was took an hour and was mostly what happened that evening.
Well, in my group, I noticed a lot of differences and a lot of similarities, but I just really liked that there were different types of people in my group. They were young women of color, they were older women who were a part of the second wave, and so just seeing us talk about it and the fact that even though we are from different generations, we still have the same goals and the same interests. And that really warmed my heart, and it made me so happy to see all these people discussing these things. And this is not something that is just a little conversation. It's a huge conversation that people really, really care about, and that makes me so happy.
Yeah, it was just wonderful. And then the very last part where the report backs from each group had a spokesperson who said what everyone did agree on in that group. So this is a giant amassing of thought. We're going to go back to a little bit more of that. Let me just tell the audience that you're listening to The Joy of Resistance, Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI. We come to you the first and third Wednesdays of every month, 9 to 10 p.m. And tonight we are talking about some of the feminist activism that has been taking place, particularly the first ever New York City Feminist General Assembly of Occupy Wall Street. Our guests are Lorena D'Ambrosio in the studio and Dior Vargas, and on the phone we have Judith Levine. Let me go back to, and let me also give the station break, actually. You're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York City. Let's go back to a little bit more of the report backs. Well, maybe we can hear some of track two, and so people will get an idea of what happened in that latter part of the evening.
We all had a great conversation.
I'm afraid I won't do it justice.
But we had a couple specific things
that haven't yet been mentioned.
We would like
the Occupy Movement support
in fighting the attacks on women.
And in promoting the equality of men and women.
We would like
The old WS tweets.
To include more women's issues.
Many of us believe
we need to transform this sexist, racist, classist, imperialist.
System
in order for women to have true equality.
I'm just going to report back according to the three categories.
Okay, there's so much more there where I think something like 20 people got up and gave report backs. We are unfortunately running out of time for this segment, and we'll have to have you back and we'll have to get updates. But I want to ask you, my two guests in studio and Judith Levine on the phone, to talk a little bit about what happened after this hugely successful event, 300 people laughing and talking and thinking together. What was the aftermath within your group, and we should say it was organized by the Women of Wall Street group, right?
Okay. Yeah.
And what are the plans for the future? Lorena, you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. Well, basically what we do, since after the first FEMGA, we've been having weekly meetings. So what we've been doing is we've been taking these report backs. We've been taking each individual item and seeing how we could make it grow into a more form of action, what we can do to move forward. We've been talking about clinic defense. We've been talking about even doing like these screenings where we could get people together to watch feminist documentaries, just telling people, just making them more aware of global issues too, issues around the world that are going on with women as well. Mm-hmm. And just making it grow in a way to where it's not only, you know, us gathering and you know, sharing ideas, that's excellent, but how we can take action on it and, you know, move forward and be involved in marches and, you know, even as the Feminist General Assembly, we wanted to be present in lots of other groups too and make sure we establish our presence there as well.
Mm-hmm. When is the next Feminist General Assembly?
The next Feminist General Assembly is Monday, June 18th, 6:30 p.m. at Washington Square Park, just in time to kick off Pride Week.
Okay. Dior, what's your take on what's going to happen and the aftermath?
It's very exciting to see what's come out of the first one, and it's really, I think, in part of it, in summing up in three words, it's about education, action, and outreach, just to educate people about what we're all about and what our issues are. Mm-hmm. And I mean, just doing that and trying to make change with the action items. And I'm really excited about the things that have been coming out of our meetings. So we're hoping that with that, a lot of people will attend the next one. We really hope a lot of people come, just like the first one. So the more people, the better.
Are these meetings open?
They're open to everyone.
Oh, for sure. Yes,
Judith, why don't you tell us
that? Yeah, I'd like to add to this that another thing we've talked a lot about is the outreach part. And that is that a real failure, I think, of Occupy Wall Street, not necessarily all the Occupies, not Occupy Brooklyn, is that it is a largely white and young collection of people. And so we want to work with other groups, other pro-feminist groups in the city. We want to have our General Assembly in other places.
Twinkling
in
fingers
other
here.
With other groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, excellent.
Up twinkles. Too.
Excellent. Just wonderful. Gee, I wish we'd had time to play the part where when the report backs, one of the people said that they want to ask the men to stop what they call mansplaining. What is mansplaining? We're going
to
end on
that. You're something to a woman that she already knows.
Yes.
And lectures her as if she were a child.
I have to say, we had so many men and male-identified people there as feminist allies.
Yes, we did.
I really felt kind of uncomfortable with that because I feel like feminism is for everyone.
It is.
So you felt comfortable or uncomfortable with that?
I felt uncomfortable with saying that about all men. I mean,
I see. I see.
Because there were so many, you know, wonderful men there.
I see. Well, there were, but I think that's such a problem that we don't want the presence of men to keep us from identifying the problems either. Would you agree with that? Okay. Unfortunately, we have to bring this wonderful segment to an end. I thank you all so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Lorena D'Ambrosio and Dior Vargas and Judith Levine, and we'll have to have you all back. And, tell us the date one more time of the next Feminist General Assembly.
Yes, that is Monday, June 18th, 6:30 p.m., Washington Square Park.
Okay, Monday, June 18th, 6:30 p.m. Be there. And we're going to go out with a piece by Sandy Rapp, which is about the excitement of a whole earlier era that somehow these events are making me connect with again. And I can't remember the name of it, but anyway, she mentions Betty Friedan walking up Fifth Avenue with about 70,000 women. And I understand that on this coming August 26th, there's going to be an attempt to replicate that march of 42 years ago. You'll be hearing about that. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was a time of dark and sad song. 7 years was well up in and gone. Among the leaders from the days of long ago, a troubled time had taken out its toll. And there was one from Illinois. It's told how Betty broke a new and grueling ground. She went marching in Manhattan up Fifth Avenue, you know. And she wrote a book that turned the world around. Rise up, ye women, or the vintage it will fail, cried old prophet Isaiah, so they say. And they rose up, the mighty women of a new and moving age, and they grew to be the prophets of their day. And there was one from old Montgomery. She rode a bus to freedom, it is told. She went marching by with into history arose a road. And there were two from Pennsylvania, where liberty is run from every bell. Molly Yard went marching to the rally in the sky.
Faded out.
Morris Tucker left as well.
Okay, rise up, ye women, Sandy Rapp. We're going to go on now to another event that we're covering tonight that took place about a week ago at the Society for New York Society for Ethical Culture, I want to say that correctly, a panel called The Resurgence of Misogyny that featured Katha Pollitt, who writes for The Nation, Deborah Spar, who is the president of Barnard College, and Nancy Northrup of the Center for Reproductive Rights. And they had a very fascinating, wide-ranging discussion about the larger scene that's going on in this country for women right now and what it all means. And I hope you will enjoy this recording. I'm going to take that away right now.
So I'd like to start with Nancy. There was a New York Times editorial a week ago Saturday chronicling what the title called The Campaign Against Women. And it includes quite a few limitations on abortion, but also on family planning and other health concerns. Years ago, I had thought that the anti-choice movement would just shoot themselves in the foot if they ever admitted they were really against something like birth control or abortions for medical reasons. But they've admitted it. Where's the outrage from the mainstream?
I actually think we've seen a fair amount of outrage, and I think that a piece in the Times is one of it, but we also saw it across the nation. In Virginia, there was a law that actually has passed in some other states requiring a forced vaginal sonogram for women going through an abortion and then having them have to view it. And it picked up steam in recent months because all of a sudden I think there has been an alert to the fact that this is not just about abortion, it's also about contraception. Obviously, the dust up around the comb and breast cancer issues with Planned Parenthood, and then culminating all of it was the outrageous, you know, remarks by Rush Limbaugh for the woman who testified in favor of no-cost contraception as part of health care reform. And in fact, it really is not just about abortion. It's about contraception. It's about women's sexuality. It's about women's agency. It's about women's decision-making. And I think that that hand has finally been shown.
Thanks. Katha, especially in areas of reproductive rights, we know that middle-class folks, like most of the people sitting here, aren't as affected as the poor. Do you see a disproportionate effect of these issues on poor women? What role does class play in all of this?
I think it's huge, and geography is also very important. It's interesting, even the transvaginal ultrasound thing in Virginia, that law is on the books in many other states, including Texas. There was no big outcry or big media thing, but Virginia is right next to Washington. There's tons of reporters there. There's a big media market. There's politics. There's everything. So it was easy for them to cover the story, and it was easy for the story to pick up a lot of steam. And I think what you find is that the most restrictions are in the South and in rural states like the Dakotas. So I think that our federal system, our state system, has allowed a lot of terrible things to happen in places that, you know, don't really get too much news coverage of any kind and where people don't feel very connected. You know, how connected are you in New York City with something that happens in Utah? Not very. And I think the class thing is very relevant also there, because as long as it's possible for a middle-class person over 18 to get an abortion in much of the country, it's really not going to be a huge issue for those people that a poor woman can't get a Medicaid abortion. The Hyde Amendment in 1976, that was huge. That was huge. That basically said, you can have an abortion if you can pay for it. But the federal government isn't going to pay for it, and the states don't have to pay for it if they don't want to. And ever since then, the appeal, that sort of libertarian, sure, do what you want, but I don't want to pay for it argument has been extremely powerful.
Deborah, this class divide goes beyond just abortion rights. If we look at the current focus in the campaign about how women who choose to stay at home with their children are being viewed versus women who choose to work, as if all women have that option or those options. As someone working with a group of soon-to-be professional women, how are they responding to the current climate in the campaigns that are going on?
Let me just sort of step back a little bit and look at it from perhaps even a broader lens. This has been a really interesting 6 months for 18 to 22-year-old young women. This is a group, particularly women, who never really grew up thinking their lives would contain anything but choice. I'm talking here about middle, upper middle class, and wealthy kids. Not only choice in a reproductive sense, which they've always just assumed to be essentially a God-given right because they've never known a world without it. If you've always had it, it's very hard to imagine not having it. But they've also grown up with choice across every range of possibilities. Think of what you've probably said to your own daughters or girls in your life. Of course you can be whatever you want to be. You can do whatever you want. You can go to whatever college you want. You can have any sexuality you want. We've given these girls, now young women, this sort of dream of choice. And again, in a moment in their lives when they don't see it as a dream, it's just a reality. Of course I can do whatever I want. I mean, they just presume that. And all of a sudden, literally in the past 9 months, that reality seems to be coming under question for them. And it's utterly confusing. At an abstract level, they get this, that there's a change in the political consciousness, there's an election underfoot, they get that. But what I think they're facing at a much more visceral level is, wait a minute, you mean this wasn't always mine? And it's actually forcing them. I must confess that some of my older alums are kind of rubbing their hands in glee, because for 30 years they've been saying, how come they don't appreciate what we fought for? And all of a sudden there is this sort of generational dialogue going on, which is, you know, it's unfortunate that we've had some nasty political events bringing it to the fore. I would predict that the young women coming and graduating college right now become more politicized than the kids we've seen graduating over the past 5 to 10 years. Not only around women's issues and issues of choice, but of course they're also graduating into an economic recession. These are kids who grew up in very comfortable circumstances, demographically speaking. And all of a sudden they're realizing they can't have it all. And that's kind of terrifying for them.
I want to mention a little something that happened the other day. I was rereading a Katha Pollitt article, and this was from 2001, I think. It was a law that was requiring doctors to tell women seeking abortions that it would increase their chance of breast cancer. But then I opened my emails and read that some legislator in Kansas was trying to pass that law today. So I'll put it to all three of you. Why do these things keep coming back?
Well, I think that the anti-choice movement, I think they're very shrewd and they're very determined. And they have a lot of arguments that they want to use to dissuade people from having abortions. And some of them are old faithfuls, like you'll get breast cancer.
I should have said, and the studies show that there's no connection.
Right, yes. That's the other thing. There is no connection. But they like to think that there is. They use scare tactics. They'll tell you, you know, you'll be infertile. Your boyfriend or husband will leave you. I mean, of course, your relationship will break up. And you'll regret it forever. So they use a whole lot of different scare tactics to scare people out of having abortions. And since these tactics don't work very well, they have to keep doing them again and again. I think, you know, that it's easy to make fun of the anti-choicers when we're sitting here at the Ethical Culture Society, and they often can seem they're very religious, and they're often come from more rural parts of the country, so they're not, you know, culturally sophisticated, but they're very politically sophisticated. And they've had years and years and years of getting better and better and better at it, and I don't know that our side has gotten better and better at it. I think we're pretty much doing the same things we've always been doing.
And I just guess I'll jump into this discussion to say that I take quite seriously the anti-choice movement and its objectives. We are in an ideological battle with them. This is a fundamental difference where religion is at the base of it, about the role of women in society, about the role of sexuality in people's lives, about whether sex for pleasure is something that is acceptable or not acceptable. I mean, remember, the abstinence-only programs, which still exist and which, you know, are federally funded, the principle of those programs is that sex between a man and a woman in the context of marriage is the only acceptable form of sexual activity. I mean, that's a statement with which I don't agree. And, you know, part of the problem, I think, of the pro-choice movement is we actually don't say clearly what we don't agree with. we won't own what we believe. And like saying, it's not just, you know, we think those are bad programs because they don't work. I think that's a bad statement about the role of sexuality in people's lives. So that's a big debate. And I think that we need to appreciate that. And that our opposition, they're getting up every day to say, how am I going to advance this? They see this as really central to their lives. And we have to see that same centrality to our lives. Intensity matters in politics, and it matters in capturing people's, you know, minds and ideas and hearts. And so I think we need to just commit that this is not about one election or passage of some legislation, and we're not going to slide backwards. This is a long-term, you know, it's like ideological battles about, you know, capitalism versus socialism. They don't go away. You got to be in it for the long term if you feel deeply about what the outcome is.
I spent a lot of time looking at trade policy. And one of the very odd anomalies in U.S. trade policy and foreign policy more generally is our policy towards Cuba. Right? The U.S. has had an incredibly harsh policy towards Cuba that, especially since the end of the Cold War, kind of makes no sense. Why do we have this policy? It's because that we don't vote on this policy in terms of absolute majorities. If you polled every person in the United States, our embargo against Cuba would probably disappear overnight. What drives U.S. policy towards Cuba is the incredibly strongly held views of a very small number of Cuban Americans who just care so much more about Cuban policy than the vast majority of Americans. So I may think the embargo is sort of silly, but I'm not wasting any of my time organizing to dismantle the embargo, whereas there's a very committed group in Florida, which is a large swing state, that has devoted generations of political activism to keeping this policy in place. So does the policy make sense on a rational national level? No. Does it make sense politically? Absolutely. Because if you want to win Florida, watch every candidate, regardless of party, go down and court the Cuban-American vote. It's a perfectly rational thing to do politically. I think you have something similar around abortion politics, albeit much more complicated. That there is a group of people, again now generations long, who are going to fight no matter what for pro-life policies. So you have a very strong coalition on one side and a very diffuse set of interests with probably a great deal of variation among the people who would consider themselves pro-choice. And they're rarely going to be the ones who are fighting on the barricades to the same level that the pro-life forces are.
Just to look at it a little, follow up a little bit on the politics of it. It's not just that the Cubans in Florida have this tremendous geographical advantage. If they were spread out evenly all over America, they wouldn't have that. There are too few of them. So the pro-lifers have the advantage of being very concentrated in certain regions where they're very numerous and that are smaller, and where they can hook on to very strong general conservatism of those states. But they have another advantage, which is that it's organized in churches. Churches are places people go every week. It's really easy to keep everybody on the same page. It's easy to organize them politically. It's easy to organize the fundraising. After the church service, you can have everybody write their letter to their congressman, whatever. We don't have anything like that. Our political organization is much more distant. Every day I get an email, you know, we're Planned Parenthood, give us some money. But it's very rarely, we're Planned Parenthood, here is a meeting we want you to come to and we're all going to strategize about how we can get this person elected or how we can raise money for this or organize the demonstration. That's done in a different way with more grassroots activists.
Having an African-American president, someone had asked about the earlier, before we met, about the linkage between racism and misogyny. And in addition to looking at our president, I'm also thinking of our first lady, because we have a very strong, healthy, real woman at the helm, and she's also a black woman. So does anyone have any comments on any of the interaction between the oppressions or the isms or anything along those lines that you'd like to add?
Well, I think Michelle Obama has certainly come in for her share of racist and sexist
remarks and comments. But you know, I just want to broaden it out because you brought up the internet. You can look at any article that's posted online, and the comments section underneath will turn into a fiesta of racism and sexism almost instantly. For example, I don't know if any of you look at the website Gothamist, which is about New York City. It's just unbelievable. If there's some crime, oh, well, we know that's a black person, and then, you know, full, you know, onslaught of racism. And I think the anonymity of the web, well, it's a cliche, the anonymity allows people just to say whatever they want, the things that they thankfully have to repress in normal, polite society. I get this as a writer. Every woman writer gets this. There's that, you know, there's the rough and tumble of discussion and all like that, but then there's something added. There's something added, which when you're a woman, which is often grossly sexualized commentary, comments about your looks, comments about the assumption that you're stupid because you're a woman. And I think that there has been a study that shows, you know, women get like 25 of these comments for every one a man gets. And I think there really is this thing of like, we don't want women in the public world. We do not want them expressing their opinion. We don't want to have to listen to them. And this, we saw this with Rush Limbaugh and Sandra Fluke, you know, where he called her a slut and a prostitute and all the rest of it. But we see it from the liberal side, too. For example, well, I wouldn't want to call Larry Flint a liberal, but he just did a really disgusting pornographic photo of a conservative columnist named S.E. Cupp, who is on TV and writes around. He didn't like what she was saying, and so, you know, let's put a dick in her mouth, ha, ha, ha. And there's, I brought an article here that just has this long, long list of horrible things said by Bill Maher and by Keith Olbermann, by Chris Matthews. I wrote a piece about Hillary Clinton, Satan's daughter or something like that. And just this, the list of evil, horrible things said about Hillary Clinton by people that are very powerful in the media. Not, you know, weirdos with a blog, but people that are on important news channels. It's very, very disturbing, and it's become even more pervasive. And I think, you know, when I first think of misogyny, I don't even think of, like, oh, yeah, reproductive rights. I think just the general coarse and disgusting nature of so much conversation around everything having to do with women. Everything. And I think it has an effect. That's the other thing. I think it really, even, you know, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Words have an effect. People become afraid. How are they going to be seen? Will they think I'm fat? You know, stuff like that.
The last time I was on the O'Reilly Factor, which was always the times I would get the worst emails.
And we're going to have to, unfortunately, fade out that wonderful panel with Katha Pollitt and Deborah Spar and Nancy Northrup. I want to thank all of the listeners who listened in tonight. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is The Joy of Resistance. We will be back in 2 weeks on June 20th. Be sure to follow us on Twitter. We're so excited to be on Twitter at twitter.com/joyofresistance, and you'll get lots of really interesting feminist tweets if you do that. Go to our blog at joyofresistance.wordpress.com, and we're looking for women to volunteer to help become our new feminist news bureau and gather these stories and help to even report them. So get in touch with us at Twitter or on our blog. We'd love to hear from you, and we'd love to get your comments on the show tonight in either of those places. Take care and keep on the struggle. It's getting exciting out there. Good night.
Yeah. What? You're on your own. We'll stand with you till you're born. After that, you stand alone. Do you join this world?
And I just wanted to tell you what you're listening to. You're listening to a rap song from Words of Choice, and this is about a right wing that cares about you when you're in the womb, but unfortunately not afterwards. It's called You're On Your Own.
until you take one step beyond the amniotic sac. Because while you are an embryo, you're innocent and sweet. But once you are a baby, you become a welfare cheat. Now your mama, she didn't count on you when she went out to play, but count on us to see that you're the price she'll have to pay. Because of us, you're free to live whatever life you please, as long as you don't start to think that food stamps grow on trees. You're on your own, yeah. You're on your own. We'll stand with you till you're born. After that, you stand alone. Till you join this world of strife, Lord, you got a right to life. But after that, well, I'm afraid you're on your own.
Our love of life is ridiculed by baby-killing cynics.
Yeah.
We'll show them our sincerity
by blowing up some clinics.
Boom. We hope you aren't hurt when the explosion goes
kerplow.
But with what your mother plans to do, you're a goner anyhow.
Well, the Lord works in mysterious ways, his wonders to reveal. Perhaps someday we'll meet while you are scrounging for a meal. But a soul that knows no hardship is a soul that goes unfed. The only perfect people are the unborn and the dead. Still, we ask that Jesus shelter you with loving hands so mild.
From undesired pregnancy to undesired child.
To a juvenile delinquent.
Word.
To a death row prison cell.
Hey.
And when you walk that final mile, you know it all too well. You're on your own, yeah. You're on your own. We'll stand with you till you're born. After that, you stand alone. Till you join this world of strife, Lord, you got a right to life. But after that, well, I'm afraid you're on your own.
And the preceding program, The Joy of Resistance, was brought to you live with certain portions on recording. You are tuned to WBAI in New York and WBAI.org on the World Wide Web. The Women's Collective is next here on WBAI. Please stay tuned. Time is 9:59:38, and the Women's Collective will be coming up in just a few moments. Again, it's tuned to WBAI in New York and WBAI.org.
Good evening and welcome to the broadcast. I'm Marianne Miller and I'm here with Emily No.
It's great to be here.
Yes, it's always good when you're here. We're going to discuss our, later on in the program, our favorite people, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, Julian Assange, the Queen, and that damn Jubilee. But first, we're going to hear an interview that Prairie Miller did with Maggie Gyllenhaal on the Hysteria, the story of the vibrator, and also with the director of the film, Tanya Wexler. So here we go with Prairie's piece.
This is Prairie Miller, and on the show today, a tale of two movie topics, suffragettes and sex toys, in the bittersweet feminist comedy Hysteria. based on actual events that played out during, of all things, the Victorian era in late 19th century England. Hysteria revisits a both turbulent and tragic time when the suffragette movement battled for female empowerment, even as female activism and sexual urges were deemed forms of mental illness, collectively classified as hysteria, and suppressed often through institutionalization in insane asylums. But director Tanya Wexler uncovers one highly unusual cure involving male difficulty and denial accepting female oppression back then, the birth of the vibrator, and its implementation as a medical procedure applied by physicians to cure all manner of female depression, resentment, and rebellion, and apparently resulting in a procession of therapeutically satisfied female patients. Director Tanya Wexler phoned into Arts Express to talk about the peculiar history of the vibrator, initially as an alleged medical device, and shedding light on the male perspective on women in the late 19th century in general. Also, Wexler's thoughts on what all this may have to do with medicalizing sexuality, carpal tunnel syndrome, and polishing furniture, the absence of sexual consciousness, and the mystery behind the need to marginalize others in society. Dispensing vibrators at screenings of her movie, and what her uncle, distinguished filmmaker Haskell Wexler, has been up to at this historic moment in time over at Occupy Chicago. But first, we'll be hearing from the star of Hysteria, Maggie Gyllenhaal, who stopped by to talk about her role as Charlotte, a suffragette butting heads with authorities at the time, and what it meant to her to play a woman too busy changing the world to give much thought to what's going on in her physician father's office, sexually speaking. Gyllenhaal also assesses the politics of female body parts in history, including ankles, and the gains of the women's movement when it comes to evaluating the vibrator versus the dishwasher. This interview is excerpted from the original interview on Arts Express that aired nationally on the Pacifica Radio Network. First, Maggie Gyllenhaal, then director Tanya Wexler.
I guess I think everybody who lives in this time, or a lot of people would like to imagine that we would have been like Charlotte if we lived back then. I mean, I would like to imagine that I would have been, but I think it would have been incredibly difficult to actually be like that. And I think she's kind of, like, I wasn't concerned at all when I did it with her being historically accurate. You know, I just wanted her to be alive and wild and, you know, like, full of being a woman, you know, like she could be from any time or any planet, you know. I think it would have been incredibly difficult to survive if you were actually like that back then. And, you know, and there's all these things in the movie that sort of gave me, in the script even, that gave me clues that that was the way to go. Like, you know, at the very end, he says, you know, will you be all right in prison? And she says, yeah, I've got tons of friends in prison. You know, but the truth is, like, would she have been all right in a Victorian prison? But I don't think that I think, you know, the politics that she's talking about in the movie are so simple. And they're things that we so all take for granted now. You know, women should be able to go to college and we should be able to have jobs and vote. And if I took her to, you know, historically, literally, I think she would have been kind of boring.
Did you base her on any, did you do research for this role and base her on any women?
Not really. I mean, I did research, I guess, in this movie, sort of more inside myself, like challenging myself to be as wild and as free and as, you know, strident as I could be. You know, because and that's kind of why I decided to do the movie, really, was I thought it would be fun to see how wild I could be, you know. I mean, and in a lot of ways, it's funny, I've played characters who are a lot wilder, you know, who do, but in the constraints of that time and those clothes, and I just thought it'd be cool to see how far I could go. That's the thing. I mean, if this had been a realistic drama about suffragettes at the turn of the last century, well, then you have to do a different kind of research, and then you have to be historically accurate, and it comes a totally different thing to ask of you. I think that not only is it a comedy, but I really like the style of comedy that it is. You know, that it's like that English, clever, you know, really tight dialogue where you have to pay attention and you have to use your brain. As much as there's also all these jokes, you know, about orgasms and stuff, you know, which is great. It's a great mix. Charlotte doesn't have that much to do with that, but, you know, I liked the mix of this kind of intellectual comedy with, like, you know, ladies having loud orgasms in doctor's offices. In terms of the historical accuracy, things like Mortimer Granville, you know, people's names and things are shifted and changed, but the fact is that the vibrator was invented to masturbate women who were considered hysterical. And so then you go, like, how is it really true that these people who couldn't look at a woman's ankle thought that they could give a woman an orgasm and that was considered like a medical procedure? Like, was it, I mean, really, don't you think men have known what a woman's orgasm was for a long time? I mean, it's not like it just happened in 1925 or something, you know? I think, I believe that either there was this massive amount of disassociation that was just like running rampant, which I think is probably partially true and probably partially what led to all of this, you know, quote unquote hysteria. But also, I think there must have been a sexuality in it. I mean, how could there not have been? I mean, people have been having sex a long time and enjoying themselves. So, I mean, in this case, I think both the part of Jonathan Pryce's part and Hugh Dancy's part, I think both are incredibly difficult lines to walk between believing somewhere that they're doing something that's medically necessary and also knowing somewhere inside them that they're giving women orgasms, you know? So that's such a complicated one.
What have been the reactions of different audiences to the film?
I think we've come really far. I mean, I think it would be silly to say that we're, or maybe not silly, but would be thoughtless to say that we're in the same place we were then. I think we've come really, really far. But I also have been, you know, I've only seen the movie all the way through one time. Which is when I was in Toronto. And, you know, so that was mostly like an American and Canadian audience. And then I watched it in Rome, just the very end. You know, sometimes we'll just like pop in at the end because I've already seen it. And I've done kind of a lot of international press on it, talked to people in Italy and Scandinavia, all over. And I have been surprised, but not that surprised, I guess, by how shocking the movie is. Like, when I saw it in Toronto, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's a romantic comedy, it's just a sweet movie, but then the orgasm stuff and, like, women thinking about their bodies that way, when I watched it, because I wasn't a part of shooting any of that stuff. You know, Charlotte doesn't use the vibrator ever, you know? But when I watched it, I was, like, kind of flushed, and people in the audience were hysterically laughing. And it came out of, I think, a kind of, like, not being used to seeing stuff like that. And even I felt that way. And I, you know, the first movie I really made was, like, an S&M movie. You know, I mean, like, I do not think of myself as prudish, you know, at all. I'm interested in sex. I'm curious about it. I think of myself as pretty open, but I was surprised by my own response and the audience's response I've seen every time I've been around the movie and been interviewed about it, by how kind of uncomfortable it still makes us. At the same time, I think we've come a huge way, you know, really far from, you know, 1880, whatever. That's what they, it's so funny, they keep saying that about us, that we're so prudish, and I think, I don't know, I think we're pretty equal, pretty even, you know, I don't think there's a massive difference, you know. But I had some really interesting conversations with women in Italy about it. My favorite one was where this woman said, asked me, which did I think had done more for women's rights and the women's movement, the vibrator or the dishwasher? I think I have to go with the dishwasher.